Good evening, everybody. My name is Jim Allen. I'm one of the ministers here, and I want to say a word of welcome to all of you on behalf of Camrose United Church. It's a delight to see so many of you out here this evening, and a real honor for us as a congregation to be able to host this event, which I would say is a very momentous event in the evolution of this whole field of study for the University of Alberta and Augustana campus and Camrose itself. And I also want to invite you at the end of the forum to stay for a time of refreshments in our church hall and fellowship. And so I wanted to just have an opportunity to say a brief word of introduction for David Goa, and then he's going to handle things for the rest of the evening. But the Chester Ronning Center, of course, is new to the University of Alberta and Augustana and Camrose, and it's an exciting venture, and even more exciting now that we've been able to have David Goa take over as the director. David was born here in Camrose. I was just delighted to learn that. Both of his parents are buried in the local cemetery and all that sort of thing. So he's really ours from the beginning, and we're just pleased to have him back. I first heard his name when I came here 6 years ago, and at that time he was with the Provincial Museum, curator of culture, and the motivating force between that marvelous presentation, Anno Domini, collection of historical artwork. And we took a busload of about 35 people from this congregation and just had a marvelous time. But after all this time, it's just a delight to meet David in person. He has a tremendous background. He has taught religious studies as well as work with museum and so on, but this isn't the time to recite all that. I just want to welcome David here and ask you to join me in welcoming David Goa.
My mother and father both lie in the boneyard. The fact that I've been welcomed into the United Church may have caused them to turn over slightly. But then, they like to turn over in any case. And I'm sure that now that they dwell in paradise, they know completely how wonderful it is to have friends everywhere. Thank you very much. We're delighted to have our first Ronning Forum, the first of many, I trust, to come over the next number of years, and to have it here at Camrose United Church. And we thank the church and the members of the church, and also a special note of appreciation to Reverend Jim Allen. Why are we here? If we were able, with some sort of super magnet, to extract from today's newspapers or from the radio or television broadcast that you may have heard of the news, all those stories that have unfolded because of the human struggle with values, the human desire to be faithful to what is claimed as ultimate, the desire to enlarge the civil sphere, or the desire to diminish it, the entanglement of religion and public life. How much would be left? Did you read the paper today? How much would be left? Try it tomorrow as a little exercise. Religion and public life, whether or not it is adequate to refer to them as two spheres of life or not, are both central to many of the hard and difficult questions of our day. This is so locally, nationally, and internationally. And the Ronning Center was created here at the University of Alberta on the Augustana campus to engage these wonderful and difficult questions. Through our work together, we will all learn more about the depth of religious and civil values. And I suspect we will all become a touch more humble in the face of what we know and of what we are not so certain that we know. Our work will be conducted in three spheres: in the academy, in the public square, such as tonight, and in religious communities. The United Church in Camrose is a kind of cathedral, you know, so it is a public square. In the religious communities, where we are asked to participate in exploring difficult themes and issues. So welcome. It's lovely to see you, and I'm delighted that you're all here and that we are beginning this good and demanding and wonderful work together. We begin in earnest tonight, and we begin in a quite special place within Canadian religious and civil life. And I am pleased and delighted to welcome Bill Blakey to give the keynote for the evening. Mr. Blakey has held numerous critical portfolios for the Federal New Democratic Party caucus during the 25-plus years that he has represented his Winnipeg constituency in the House of Commons. I must admit, I am still trying to absorb the fact that he is the longest-serving member of Parliament in Canada. I don't know why I find that curious, but I do. I suspect that our new Prime Minister finds it a bit curious as well. And anything I can share with our new Prime Minister, I'm delighted to do that. He is passionate about Parliament, which is a wonderful thing, and is known for his commitment to the environment, to Medicare, quality public service, to fair trade, to democracy, and parliamentary reform, something that he shares with our current Prime Minister, and for his criticism of the corporate model of globalization. He was first elected to the House of Commons in 1979. He's been elected 8 times and is recognized as the Dean of the House. He is not the bishop of the house, but he is the dean of the house. Bill Blakey was born and grew up in Transcona in Manitoba, Winnipeg, studied philosophy and religious studies at the University of Winnipeg, a master's of divinity at the Toronto School of Theology, and then did outreach work on the north end of Winnipeg. And talking with him about that a little bit, I couldn't help but have flashbacks to Reinhold Niebuhr, who, graduating from Union, went to work in Detroit and had his liberal Protestant theology shook up by that experience. Mr. Blakey was ordained to the ministry of the United Church of Canada in 1978. I'm delighted he's here, and his keynote this evening is titled "Preaching the Social Gospel in the 21st Century: Challenging Secular, Religious, and Market Fundamentalisms." And you will note that the Ronning Center is going to take the particular seriously wherever it is found. And so I am equally delighted to invite tonight as our respondent my friend and colleague who for many years served in the wonderful cabinet of Brian Mulroney, Dr. Walter McLean, and is a Presbyterian minister and has done marvelous work in Africa and continues to do it, is a senior partner in the Osborne Group, and a man with whom I have had such lovely conversations about these issues of religion and public life. We've asked him to respond, and I'll ask him to do that immediately following Mr. Blakey's presentation. What we will do then, following that, is we will gather here, and we will talk together. This is a forum, although I would prefer to use that wonderful Greek word, symposium, which really means dinner party. And we will talk and think together about a number of these issues, and then there will be an opportunity for us to talk and think together with at least some of you who are here. So welcome. Thank you, Mr. Blakey.
I'd like to begin by thanking David Goh for thinking of me as someone who might be appropriate to be here this evening. I certainly think it a topic and a field of study growing more and more relevant with the passage of each day, the relationship between religion and public life. And so I'm very happy to participate in the early stages of this Chester Ronning Institute for the Study of Religion and Public Life, and very happy to have discovered, because I didn't know it before, that I had this connection with Chester Ronning. He was actually the first person ever to run on the provisional CCF platform in 1932 for the United Farmers of Alberta, even before the convention in Regina that everyone thinks was the beginning of the CCF, and then of course was later the CCF leader in Alberta for a couple of years. I'm also very pleased to have my former colleague in the House of Commons, Walter McLean, here. Walter and I served on the External Affairs Committee of the House of Commons for a number of years together. And as I was recounting at dinner, Walter and I had this habit that made us different than other MPs when we were traveling. On Sunday mornings, we always tried to find a church together. And we had some interesting experiences in different countries, which I won't go into. But in honor of Walter's Scottish heritage and mine, I thought I'd begin with a story I heard not too long ago about a Scotchman being discovered on an island that he had been stranded on for a great long time, and he had three houses, three structures. And they asked him, well, why have you got three structures? And he said, well, that's my house. That's my kirk. If you know what a kirk is in Scottish lowlands, as you know. And that's the kirk I'll no set foot in. I see you're all familiar with Scottish church history. Anyway, I'm very glad to be here tonight and to have had the chance to do some disciplined thinking about a difficult topic. And I will certainly be grateful for your attention, but I am used to speaking in the House of Commons. So if at some point I seem to be dozing off, just be rude, and I'll feel at home, and things will proceed from there. Now, during a speech in Toronto in the fall of 2002, at a debate organized during the NDP leadership race, I made a reference to the social gospel as one of the traditions that inspires and informs the NDP, and in the question period that followed, I was taken to task by a woman at the back of the hall who said that gospel was a Christian concept and that by using the word gospel, I was engaging in a form of Christian imperialism that left non-Christians out of the conversation. Whether one thinks that this was an overreaction to an objective description of the origins of the party, perhaps a plant by the other campaign, or a brilliant flash of multicultural sensitivity. It nevertheless raised for me an important question. How do those of us who see ourselves in the social gospel tradition speak of ourselves and what we believe in a 21st century Canadian context that is characterized by secularism, pluralism, a touchiness on the part of many about anything Christian, and a touchiness in general about the role of religion in politics. And there most certainly will be an interface. Indeed, contrary to expectations roused in the 1960s with the God is dead phenomena, or as far back as Nietzsche, God is not dead, nor is religion, nor I might add, is idolatry. In a century that at least at its beginning seems to be dominated by issues of faith and politics, discerning idols will be a demanding and perhaps dangerous task. My hope and yours, I'm sure, is that the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life will be a place where such discernment will take place and where the proper relationship between faith and politics will come to be articulated. However we may currently decide to speak, when we speak to the present out of the social gospel tradition, it is certainly historically the case that something called the social gospel informed and informs the political left in Canada. This was recently reaffirmed in a new book by Professor Ian Mackay of Queen's University in a chapter of a book entitled Rebels, Reds, and Radicals, devoted to redefining the left, as he puts it in his introduction. He names spiritual awakening and the social gospel as one of several paths to leftist politics in Canada. But he also points out the discomfort which many on the left, on the secular left, feel when confronted with the fact that, as he puts it, and I quote, many leftists in Canada have been believers, rooting their resistance to capitalism in religious values. Now that discomfort, I believe, is part of a larger process by which the Christian left has become far less visible over the last 15 to 20 years. While at the same time, the Christian right has come to be the dominant public face of both Christianity and Christian politics. Even the global celebrity status of Pope John Paul II was conformed to this paradigm, as it was only his conservative views that attracted attention, and not his critiques of capitalism, of capital punishment, or his opposition to the invasion of Iraq. This analysis is less true in Canada than in the United States of America, but it's real enough here in Canada to be a matter of concern. And it should be a matter of concern, not just to progressive Christians, but to other progressives who want their causes or their issues, their way of looking at things, to be advanced and validated. Now, in a time when both North and South of the 49th parallel, religion is largely characterized, as I've already said, in the political arena, as a conservative force, there is this need to diversify the face of religion in the political realm and to reclaim territory that was once seen to be held in common by religion and the left. There is a need to reestablish in the public mind the fact that there are faith-informed progressive perspectives on those issues which tend to be dealt with now as if there is only a debate between faith and non-faith. In fact, what is really going on is often a debate between Canadians of the same faith, or a debate between conservative faith communities and a secular liberalism that owes its values in part to Christianity in the first place. So it's not in the best interests of Canadians to have religion caricatured as narrowly focused on only a few issues, or even worse, to have faith or religious argument come to be seen as inadmissible in public discourse about public policy options. Questions of peace and war, the economy, and the environment are also issues to be informed by faith. But there are appropriate and inappropriate ways of speaking in an explicitly faith-informed way in the public square. The task at hand for both the faithful and non-believers is to discern and to agree, if possible, on the appropriate ways of such speaking. Dismissing views purely because they are religious is an approach which throws out the wheat with the chaff. Secular fundamentalism is not the answer either, and besides, as we know, it's an illusion to think that secularists in some way or another, don't bring their fundamental beliefs to the table when they engage in political life. We all do that. It's just that some of us are more open about it than others, and some of us call our fundamental beliefs religious, and some people don't. But we all have fundamental beliefs about ultimate reality that we bring to our reasoning about political life. Now, in my view, the reason that the left in Canada was as successful as it was, relatively speaking, either in forming governments or in influencing governments, was because Canadians would often hear in what the left was saying the practical expression of what they were hearing from Scripture and from their church's teachings on Sunday mornings. In a post-Christendom context, this resonance may be more difficult to achieve. But the Christian left, or for that matter, the Christian center, must not abandon the public square to a brawl between secular fundamentalists and the Christian right. That would be an abrogation of duty to Christ and to the world. Now, speaking particularly to the American context, briefly, I am encouraged by the work of Rabbi Michael Lerner, the editor of Tikkun magazine, who is currently trying to build in the United States what he calls the Network of Spiritual Progressives, a movement designed, among other things, to end, and I quote, religiophobia among progressives. At the Summit on Meaning and Politics organized by Rabbi Lerner in Washington, D.C. in 1995, which I had the opportunity to attend and speak to, bringing a Canadian perspective to this American gathering, and I might say it doesn't matter whether they're progressive or regressive. Americans of all stripes know so very little about Canada that just to speak about the NDP or the CCF or the social gospel, that was all, oh, really? You know, that hadn't occurred to them that there might be something interesting happening up here all these years. Anyway, at this meeting, I heard one rabbi say, and I think it's apropos of this, the problem is that fundamentalists quote proof texts and get it wrong, whereas liberals, in the American sense of the term liberal, don't quote any at all. Or pursuing the same theme, it was said that the right offers false boundaries, but the left must get beyond the image of having no boundaries at all. There is a need for normative language, for what Canadian philosopher Charles Taylor has called a moral horizon, if freedom and choice are to have any value beyond the sheer act of choosing itself. But I digress. As one African-American commentator pointed out recently in an article that also referred to the Reverend Jim Wallace's book that's been out for a while now. It's called God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. And this article, referring to Jim Wallace's book, this commentator said, the last time U.S. progressives captured the national debate and transformed politics, and I'm assuming here he means the civil rights movement, the last time U.S. progressives captured the national debate and transformed politics, people of faith were at the center of the movement, not stuck in the closet. As theologian Walter Wink argues in his book Naming the Powers, too many on the secular left have dismissed, I'm quoting here, dismissed the hymns and gospel songs, the Eucharists and prayers of a Martin Luther King Jr. or Cesar Chavez as merely shrewd accommodations to the subculture with which they worked, unquote. Another way of not getting it on the left. Religion is not a tactic, although I think it is employed that way sometimes, particularly on the right. Now, when they're not being confined to the closet by their fellow progressives, progressive Christians are often under attack or being shunned by their fellow Christians. Just the other week after the election, I looked at a copy of Christian Week, a Canadian weekly newspaper published in Winnipeg. There was an article about Christian candidates getting ready to serve in Parliament. Big banner headline on just on the inside page. I looked in vain for any reference to me. Or for that matter, any other New Democrat. Even NDP MPs whose strong Catholic commitment and involvement in their church had been highlighted in the media in the aftermath of the same-sex marriage vote and the various ways their parishes and bishops had reacted to their vote. They didn't merit any recognition. They're not within the Christian universe as far as some Christians are concerned. Now, at one time in the 70s and 80s, one could speak approvingly of the convergence of the Protestant social gospel and Catholic liberation theology in one of the more promising ecumenical trends, a trend which had manifested itself in the 70s through the work of many of the interchurch coalitions formed around social and economic justice concerns. And I'm thinking here of Gadfly, of ICRLA, if you remember your acronyms, the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America, which is why they call it ICRLA, of Project North, and a national ecumenical context in which Anglican, Catholic, United Church leaders and other church leaders like Archbishop Ted Scott, Bishop Remy DeRue, United Church moderators like Clark MacDonald and Lois Wilson, were high-profile advocates for social justice and particularly for justice for Aboriginal Canadians. The energetic and respected advocacy that was associated with the work of the churches during and following the Berger inquiry into the Mackenzie Valley pipeline was yet to be replaced by a more recent time in which the churches have been on the defensive over the tragedy and injustice of what went on as a result of residential schools. In the 1980s, the churches were talking about a new, just, participatory, and sustainable international economic order. The North-South dialogue, things like that. By the late 1990s, internationalism had been co-opted by the global corporate elite in the form of corporate globalization, the WTO, free trade, global free trade, and progressives on the left were left looking like narrow, visionless nationalists who didn't appreciate the reality of the global village. In 2006, it could be argued that the most prominent ecumenical trend is the level of cooperation between the Catholic bishops and the Evangelical Fellowship of Canada through their mutual participation in a group called the Interfaith Coalition on Marriage and the Family. Dennis Grunding, a former director of information for the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops, a former NDP MP, and now an Ottawa-based author, put forward such a view in a January 18th article on the internet news magazine Straight Goods, and I quote, "There was a time that the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops used to make regular statements on issues such as unemployment, poverty, northern development, and food security. A perusal of the CCCB website indicates that in recent years, the bishops have retreated significantly to a narrower and more conservative focus on family issues." Unquote. Now, in 1983, when the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops released a major pronouncement on the economy, which was very critical and indeed prophetic in its criticism about how the government of Pierre Trudeau was dealing with the economic crisis at that time, they were rebuked by Prime Minister Trudeau and told to stick to something they knew more about. This advice was eventually taken. Although Bishop Fred Henry of Calgary, when he isn't speculating about the eternal salvation of Catholic politicians who vote for same-sex marriage, is actually very good on the injustices of the current corporate model of globalization, and has spoken out against Ralph Klein's assault on Medicare. The culture wars had a similar effect for different reasons on the Christian left, as mainline Protestant churches like the United Church of Canada spent much of their time and energy on internal and external culture wars related to sexual orientation issues. They hadn't consciously obeyed the directive to stop talking about the economy, but their preoccupation with other issues produced a similar result. Christians on the left who wanted their churches to focus on how the prevailing model of corporate globalization was destroying the social and economic infrastructure of Canada, while at the same time contributing to global injustice and environmental exploitation, found their churches unfocused and distracted. It may also be argued that the left in general, dispirited by setbacks on the economic front, tended to redefine progressive positions in the culture wars more and more as the litmus test of what it meant to be on the left, and some encouraged an intolerance of those who were not able to accept the whole package. And this, I think, manifested itself politically in the strength that the Reform Party and the Canadian Alliance had, not necessarily in Alberta, because I don't always understand Alberta politics, but it explains why the NDP lost vote in Manitoba and Saskatchewan and all to the Reform Party, but I'll leave the Alberta phenomena up to you. The economy is a moral issue. That is really what the social gospel was all about and what it will be all about, no matter what new form it may take. The economy is every bit as much a moral issue as those issues which are sometimes set apart as moral issues and which it is sometimes argued are matters of conscience. It's always bothered me that there's been three or four issues that have been set aside. Those are moral issues, as if all this other stuff over here isn't a moral issue. Well, the reason that I see myself in this tradition, the reason that I'm a New Democrat, is because I think that the economy is a moral issue. And the social gospel says that having a global economic order, read the WTO, that doesn't even recognize, let alone enforce, core labor standards, while at the same time protecting the interests of powerful investors, that's a matter of conscience and should be a matter of national conscience when Canada is at those international tables. And I've been at a lot of the WTO meetings, and I can tell you that Canada never says boo about labor standards when they go to those meetings. Too many actual and potential laws and regulations in the interests of justice or the environment are regarded as anathema by the WTO because they interfere with the market and are called non-tariff barriers. That's a very bad thing, non-tariff barriers. But it usually has to do with something that the government is trying to do by way of protecting the environment or some level of equality or justice. Now, in my view, the way the market has been elevated from one false god among many in the political, in the human political pantheon, to the false god of the post-Cold War era and the era of free trade, as if the market existed outside of our collective obedience to it, is an open and shut case of idolatry. It is our graven image. The very nature of idolatry is to be found in humans granting godlike status or powers to something and then forgetting that those godlike powers are not independent or objective, but derived from the power they themselves grant. When we deny our own participation in reality, in this case, when we treat the marketplace as if it is not a human creation that can be changed, modified, or even eliminated, as we once did with healthcare. We took healthcare out of the marketplace and decided that healthcare would be distributed in a way that was different from the way the market distributed it before. When we do this and we act as if it's something we don't have any control over, we are forgetting that it is we ourselves who have created this particular golden calf. Now, at a national prayer breakfast in the late 90s, a conservative MP who was very active in the prayer breakfast at that time, but who was recently defeated by a New Democrat. I'm always unapologetically partisan, but never mind. Said the following in the course of publicly outlining the mission.
And I quote, "Some people say it's up to governments to get the poor out of the slums. But we in the prayer breakfast know that if we get Jesus into the hearts of the poor, they'll get themselves out of the slums." Now, one listens in vain for the prophetic word here. It seems to me that we have a clear-cut example of the great divide that exists within the Christian community. This statement, as I say, contained not a hint of what I consider to be the fundamental insight of the biblical tradition, both within the prophetic tradition of the Hebrew Testament and in the teachings of Christ himself, which is that what is needed in so many circumstances for the poor not to be poor, down through the ages, is for the rich and the powerful to have Jesus in their hearts. Or to put it in a more complex modern way, not just for the rich and powerful to have Jesus in their hearts, but also for governments, and in a democracy for voters to have Jesus in their hearts. Now, if Jesus was Lord in the hearts of the affluent and the powerful, and Lord in the hearts of voters, do we really think that tax relief for high-income earners would ever take precedence over lunch programs for hungry kids in inner-city schools? You know, some of those Christian youth groups, they like to wear those T-shirts. What would Jesus do? Well, what would Jesus do? What would Jesus pick? Would he pick tax cuts for the rich or lunch programs for inner-city schools? I mean, if we have to debate this, we've got a problem. Did Jeremiah, Hosea, Amos, and other prophets bemoan and criticize the spiritual life of the orphaned, the widow, the stranger, and the needy, and say that if only they turned to Yahweh, they would be all right? Or did they address the inadequacies and injustices of the king and the elite and the court prophets who told them what they wanted to hear? To the extent that the poor were chastised because they were part of a total people who had strayed from the path of God. They were certainly not singled out as especially in need of individual repentance or religious conversion. The role of faith or religion in public life cannot be and must not be to dress up in religious language what really are sometimes our more fundamental commitments, i.e. ideological commitments or other core public policy or political commitments. Nor, of course, should faith be an entirely individual thing, which we allow our faith to challenge and shape our personal, familial, and even collegial relationships, but not to challenge and shape the relations between rich and poor, powerful and powerless, between workers and owners, between landlords and tenants, between multinational corporations and democratically elected governments, between economic interests and environmental sustainability, between governments and the government and the governed, between citizens and society. History matters to God, as we see in the parable of the sheep and the goats. God wants to know, did we feed the hungry, clothe the naked, care for the sick, visit the prisoner, welcome the stranger? Doesn't want to know whether or not we paid appropriate homage to the mystery of the marketplace. Jesus was, as New Testament scholar Marcus Borg said in his book called The Meaning of Jesus, Jesus was from a marginalized social class in a marginalized village in Galilee, an area undergoing rapid social change and social dislocation in his time. He would have seen injustice happening around him, and whether or not he was personally a victim of it, he had an unusual sensitivity to the poor and the marginalized. Jesus got into trouble with the powers that be, initially the religious powers, because he went around saying that what they said was important wasn't. He lived in a time when the religion he grew up with was focused on matters having to do with ritual purity or personal purity. And he got into trouble when he suggested in so many ways that God really doesn't care as much about that as he cares about how we treat each other. Now later, he and his followers also got into trouble with the Roman Empire when it became obvious that they didn't accept the Romans' imperial theology, which held that Caesar was God. In his latest book, Our Endangered Values, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter talks about the overwhelming religious mandate, which he says is often ignored, I'm quoting from him now, by fundamentalists to alleviate the plight of the poor. In a chapter where he documents the growing gap between the rich and the poor in the global economy, he cites approvingly the research done by Sojourners magazine, which showed that 1 out of 16 verses in the New Testament, 1 in 10 in 3 of the Gospels, and 1 in 7 in the Gospel of Luke referred to money or to the poor. In the Hebrew Scriptures, only idolatry is more prominent than the relationship between the rich and the poor. President Carter, a devout Southern Baptist, laments the fact that over the last 25 years, there has developed a right-wing movement, and I'm quoting again here from him, often directly tied to the attributes of like-minded Christian groups, which involves special favors for the powerful at the expense of others, abandonment of social justice, denigration of those who differ, a tendency towards unilateral diplomatic action, and away from international agreements. Unquote. Now, this wouldn't necessarily have described Canada, but one can hardly forget that we have a new government in Canada which rejects the Kyoto Accord and sees tax cuts, special favors for the powerful at the expense of others, and sees tax cuts for the rich as a key element of its program. Indeed, in the last parliament, the NDP amendment to the budget, which eliminated such tax cuts, was described by opposition leader Stephen Harper as a deal with the devil. So if spending more money on education, on the environment, Aboriginal housing, overseas development assistance, and rapid transit is the work of the devil, then clearly there is a theological as well as political divide in Canadian politics. And perhaps it's appropriate that such a concrete thing as a budget amendment should occasion such theological language. Theologian Dietrich Bonhoeffer talked about Christian political choices having to be provisional and concrete. It's not enough to just utter general principles, Bonhoeffer said. You sometimes have to be for or against concrete political choices in politics. There's a need to take sides. The Prime Minister seems to understand this in his own way, even though I would want to argue that he took the wrong side. Bonhoeffer also talks about the freedom to choose, to act concretely in the world, the freedom that comes from the forgiveness of sins. Perhaps this is the freedom that the Prime Minister is acting from. I will leave what there is to forgive to the Almighty. But Mr. Harper wasn't so kind in a speech to an American conservative think tank some years ago when he jested that the existence of the NDP was, and I quote, proof that the devil lives and interferes in the affairs of men. And though there were clergy in the NDP, these same clergy believe the church, and I quote, made a historic error in adopting Christian theology. Now, as the only elected clergy in the NDP at the time of the speech, this came as news to me. That my problem with the church was that it had adopted Christian theology. It's a strange accusation, really, don't you think? An accusation that can only be made sense of if you assume that the accuser's theology, and if the accuser assumes this, you have to assume that he thinks his theology is the Christian theology, and that anybody who differs is beyond the Christian pale. Like me. Now, this raises the problem of how Christians speak to and of each other and to the world. How can the social gospel, or any gospel, be authentically and convincingly preached in a secular, pluralistic context that sees religion in a private realm and is reinforced in the wisdom of such a view of religion so many times by the way religious people speak about each other and about their non-believing fellow citizens when they criticize religion? The challenge of the social gospel in the 21st century is threefold. It's in the title of the of the talk tonight: religious fundamentalism, market fundamentalism, and secular fundamentalism. There are different combinations to look for, all of which pose difficulties for social gospelers. Religious fundamentalists, often allied with market fundamentalists, despite plenty of scripture that should make them skeptical of the market, don't like the social gospel, either because their real religion is the market, or they suspect any conclusions that come out of a gospel based on what they see as a more liberal theology. Although I would argue that much social gospel theology is actually being more literal than what sometimes passes for literalism. And it's certainly the case that not all social gospel theology can be characterized, as someone tried to do last night in a similar event like this at the University of Winnipeg, as sort of 19th century liberal theology. There's lots of us on the Christian left whose theology is neo-Orthodox, or it's Catholic liberation theology, or it's much more biblical and conservative in the best sense of the word than the liberal theology that often informed the first wave of social gospelers at the end of the 19th century. Secular fundamentalists who may be anti-market or market critical, but who, either because they are dyed-in-the-wool secularists or because they are so turned off by the arrogance of right-wing religion that they want to ban all religion from the public square. I was talking to a student today at one of David's classes, and after it was over, she came up and told me a story. She was working in the NDP campaign. And she said, someone in the NDP campaign had said, "How can you be a Christian and NDP?" And she said, "You know, that's what they say at my church." You're getting it from both sides. But it tells you a little something about the way the world is, that interface between faith and politics is being viewed out there. Now, how to speak about and from one's faith in the public realm is a challenge for all people of faith in a secular pluralistic Canada. But there is a special or unique challenge that faces Christians in doing so, and it is the legacy of having been the dominant religion for so long. It's a challenge for Christians on the right and the left. I recently spent an evening discussing this and related issues with none other than Preston Manning, the former leader of the Reform Party and a prominent evangelical Christian, at an event organized by the Manning Center for Building Democracy. It was held in Ottawa on February the 23rd. This was an event organized for the benefit of helping both small and big C conservatives navigate the faith-political interface, to use the language of the event itself. I hasten to add, especially after a recent National Post article in which I was simply listed as a speaker at this event, that I hasten to add that I was asked to represent the left-wing social gospel in the evening dialogue with Preston as a current manifestation of one of the two political movements that came out of the West, one started by J.S. Woodsworth and implemented by Douglas, and the other by Bible Bill Eberhardt, implemented by Manning's father, Ernest Manning. I was there as antagonist, or Daniel among the lions, one might say, not as one who accepted a call to train my political adversaries. Now, one of the points I made that evening was that both movements at that time, coming out of the West, Alberta and Saskatchewan, both movements assumed the reality of Christendom. That in whatever they were arguing or advocating, they could overtly appeal, each in their own way, to Christian teachings and the accepted view of Canada as a Christian country. I used examples on the left to show what I meant, quoting from M.J. Coldwell, former leader of the CCF, who used to argue for policies based on the view that it was the Christian thing to do, or the thing a Christian country ought to do. M.J. Coldwell was an Anglican with roots in the student Christian movement, a movement that mentored many of those who in 1934 formed the FCSO, the Fellowship for a Christian Social Order, that offered a radical critique of capitalism and put together a book called Toward the Christian Revolution. Now, anything today that you read about in the paper that was called the Fellowship for a Christian Social Order, you just automatically assume that that would be a right-wing conservative organization, but not in the 1930s. Not at all. So having said this, in thinking about the role of religion and or religious language in public discourse, I'm reminded of something Pierre Trudeau once did. You may remember that after the patriation of the Constitution, there was mandated a number of First Minister's meetings on Aboriginal rights. And at one of these constitutional conferences on Aboriginal rights that was mandated by that process, Prime Minister Trudeau did an unusual thing. It was customary for the Aboriginal First Nations leadership to begin the conference day with prayers offered by them to the Creator. One morning, after the Aboriginal prayers, Prime Minister Trudeau broke from the usual pattern, and instead of immediately proceeding with the meeting, he asked everyone to bow their heads, and he proceeded to recite the Lord's Prayer. Aboriginal leaders had acted as if the privatization of religion hadn't happened, and they had insisted on integrating, at least ceremonially, their religious consciousness with the constitutional political task at hand. And I wonder if we can see in that reaction of Trudeau, who was obviously irritated at the, I mean, I saw his face at the time, just sort of like, okay, you guys can pray, so can I. kind of thing, you know. But I wonder if we can see in Trudeau's reaction at that time, someone who in death was described as one with a profound Catholic faith. I wonder if we can see in his action at that time a foreshadowing of a later time in which people from many different perspectives long for a world in which their religious consciousness can be liberated from the purely private realm and appropriately validated in the public realm, not in a tit-for-tat situation, but in a context where all religious viewpoints can be confessed without feeling that one is breaking an unwritten code not to do so. The relationship between religion and politics has been more in the news or on the public agenda in Canada, really since Stockwell Day's arrival on the federal political scene some years ago now. Now, to me, as a United Church minister in Parliament for 22 years when he arrived, this was both delightful and somewhat mystifying. Delightful because I did more interviews about the relationship between faith and politics. Mystifying somewhat because I began to wonder what was either right or wrong with my own faith-based politics that it caused so little offense all those years and drew so little attention. Now, the difference between the religiosity of conservative Christian activists and small-L liberal or left-wing Christians that makes one more acceptable than the other, at least at a certain level, is in different attitudes towards Christendom. Christian talk in public places that sounds either like a lament for Christendom or a call for a return to Christendom is the kind of religious talk in public places that inspires some to want to banish it from the public square altogether. If it has an authoritarian or judgmental air to it, an attitude associated with Christendom, it offends. It sounds like a call to an earlier pseudo-theocratic time when Christians called the shots, and offends not just against the privatizing of religion, but also the reality of religious pluralism and the fact that presumably for good reasons, God has permitted Christendom to expire. I think from God's point of view, Christendom wasn't all it was cracked up to be in the way that Christians thought about it. Christians with a post-Christendom consciousness and Canadians of other faiths have a joint project in finding a new footing for Christian and other religious voices in the public realm, not by hearkening back to an earlier day, but by going ahead to a post-Christendom and post-privatization context in which religious argument is taken seriously in public discourse and religious language is allowed to enrich public discourse. And I mean all religious language. That is to say, I don't subscribe to the sometimes unspoken but not infrequently practiced view that somehow Christian language should be avoided, while it's all right to use the languages of other faiths. In other words, I don't have the memorial service at Peggy's Cove in mind as a model. For a helpful guide as to how Christians can confess Christ in a religiously pluralistic context, I would recommend a chapter in a book written by Doug Hall called Many Voices, One God, in which he rejects not just exclusivism, but also pluralism and inclusion. And he argues for the possibility of exploring in a post-Christendom context, and therefore a more biblically normal context, the biblical freedom of a confession of faith that avoids, on the one hand, the arrogance of religious exclusivity, and on the other hand, the false and manipulative humility of liberal inclusivity. So this confessional attitude that Doug Hall talks about is not unlike what I think the Christian left is up to when it confesses how it thinks the economy ought to be run. And I'm distinguishing here between small-L liberal Christians and the Christian left. Many Christians are liberal on a host of issues, but they're not left-wing when it comes to the economy. The Christian left doesn't call for a Christian social order or a Christian economic order anymore, but grounds its call for certain policies in both the biblical tradition and arguments from a vision of social and economic justice that can be embraced by Christians and non-Christians alike. The explicitly biblical argument is how unrestrained market capitalism, market capitalism has become. According to the 37th General Council of the United Church, quote, a false God which demands sacrifice of the humans, and the earth, and is therefore against our neighbors and against creation, unquote. Surely this is offensive, should offend somebody, because it's a direct theological, cosmological, and ethical condemnation of the whole world order. Yet it's not met with even an answer, let alone derision. Somehow, the churches need to find a way to be more offensive, to make their religious talk in public places and about public issues more offensive. Not in the way that Christendom talk offends. Going back here to my earlier comment about the need to find the appropriate way to speak in the public realm. So we don't want to be offensive in the way that Christendom talk offends, but we want to be offensive in the way that Christ himself offended, by exposing the lies and the hypocrisies of the rich and powerful in a way that commanded their attention, even if that attention was ultimately malevolent. At the end of the day, the challenge for people of faith is to learn not just how to talk to the world, but how to talk to each other and about each other in a way that is respectful of the faithfulness and integrity of those with whom there is disagreement on certain issues. Respect for faith-informed perspectives in public discourse will be easier to attain from others if those informed by faith show respect for each other. There will always be a role for people of all faiths to speak out of their prophetic traditions, challenging the rulers of their day to do justice, to love kindness and mercy, and to measure their political choices not in terms of how they help the rich and already powerful, but how they help the hungry, the poor, the vulnerable, the marginalized, and the environment that future generations will have to live in. The prophetic voice may not always be welcome wherever and whenever it challenges the various fundamentalisms or idols of the passing ages, but it is essential that the prophetic perspective be defended as one of the very important ways that God speaks to us in human history. Thank you for your attention.